Hi, I'm Asha Tomlinson.
And I'm David Common.
And we're hosts of CBC Marketplace. We're award-winning investigative journalists that want to help you avoid clever scams, unsafe products, and sketchy services.
Our TV show has been Canada's top investigative consumer watchdog for more than 50 years, but this is our first podcast.
CBC Marketplace podcast is available now on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition. Tonight.
The calm instead of the storm. A former Israeli national security official says Benjamin Netanyahu is facing pressure to temper his response to Iran's weekend attacks, but he sees few signs the prime minister will listen.
Fighting chance. Ottawa announces new targeted sanctions against oppressors, and an opposition leader in Belarus says they sent a crucial message to political prisoners. You have not been forgotten.
Women were the targets, according to police in Sydney, Australia, in the mass stabbing at a popular mall. A lifeguard who was there describes what he saw, how he tried to help, and who he lost.
Settling his affairs. As Donald Trump's hush money trial gets underway, a former federal prosecutor talks about what jury selection could look like and the witness she'll be watching for.
Free bird, Merlin the parrot leaves Halifax for a new life in Ontario, a destination his caregiver hopes will put some wind beneath the depressed bird's wings.
And beyond their wild nest dreams, while they're sleeping, birds sing silently. And by deciphering its song, scientists have actually determined what one bird was dreaming. As it happens, the Monday edition, radio that gives you the silent tweetment. For 2 days now, there's been a furious diplomatic effort to pull Israel back from the brink of a major escalation. Israel's war cabinet met today to decide how to respond to an enormous wave of Iranian drone and missile attacks, with many allies pushing the country not to retaliate. On Saturday, air raid sirens sounded and the skies lit up as Israeli missiles streaked to intercept the incoming projectiles. The attack was in response to the Israeli bombing of an Iranian consular building in Damascus on April 1st. Israeli defense systems were remarkably effective, reportedly destroying 99% of the missiles and drones before they could hit their targets. Eran Etzion is the former deputy head of Israel's National Security Council and a critic of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. We reached him earlier today in Shoresh, near Jerusalem.
Eran, we'll certainly discuss the politics and the implications of what happened on Saturday, but I wanted to ask you just personally, where were you on Saturday night when the attack began?
I was at home. There were no alarms actually around us. We didn't hear any alarm. And during the last months, there were occasions in which we did hear alarms and we had to go into our shelter here at home. We did see in the skies over us a number of flying objects, but that was it. And obviously we were glued to the TV, so we had the overall picture in real time, the way it was projected on Israeli media.
How would you describe how you and your family were feeling?
I guess it's hard for Canadians to really kind of understand or fully comprehend because it's so remote from your daily lives. But here in Israel, unfortunately, this is not something that we're not used to. The experience, the actual experience, the physical experience was not unfamiliar. But obviously the context was new, and what was broadcasted on TV and everything that I know as a professional following things and so on was not business as usual.
As our listeners have heard, Israel says the attack did little damage and that 99% of the drones and missiles were shot down. So what, if anything, do you believe Iran achieved with this attack?
First of all, it was to a large extent choreographed between the Iranians and the Americans and to a certain extent even Israel, in the sense that, again, we were all expecting it, even as civilians, and certainly within the decision-making circles, they obviously had a lot of information about what's going on. And then there was the transmission that came immediately after the attack, which was in a letter, in an official letter that the Iranians sent to the UN Security Council and in their other public messaging. It was, okay, that's it. From our perspective, this is now, the matter is closed. We were attacked by Israel. We retaliated from our perspective proportionally or kind of adequately. But from our perspective, this is now over.
When Iran says this is over, from their standpoint, mm-hmm. do you feel mm-hmm. that it's over from where you sit?
Well, the ball is now in Israel's court and to a certain extent in the U.S. court as well. And Israel has a choice to make. Israel can decide to, quote-unquote, play along and declare victory because, as you said, 99% of the projectiles were actually mm-hmm. intercepted. So Israel can choose to call it a day, if you will, like the Iranians have, or it can choose otherwise. It can choose to retaliate. It can choose many other actions that would kind of continue this chain of events and reaction and counter-reaction and so on. You asked me what the Iranians achieved.
Yeah.
And from their perspective, they have created what is known in the professional language as a new equation in which if Israel does X, Iran retaliates by Y. Whereas so far, the Iranians chose not to enter into this kind of game, if you will, because as we know, Israel attacked the Iranians multiple times on Syrian soil, on Iranian soil. On some of these attacks, Israel took responsibility. On some of these attacks, Israel did not. But it was very, very well known to the Iranians that it was Israel.
The last strike that time, they did not take credit for is of course, the strike early in April on the embassy complex, Iran's embassy complex in Damascus, as you mentioned. Israel has not taken responsibility. But the Israeli army and Israeli officials clearly know what's at stake here. So what do you make of those attacks that you listed and that most recent one? Why would they do that?
That's a very good question. From my perspective, I think it was a grave mistake by Israel to take this action. And it's not quite clear what was known to the decision makers, who actually were the decision makers outside of Netanyahu, obviously. So there was an underestimation or a wrong assessment by our intelligence services. And, you know, they're at fault from their perspective. But there is also the higher level of decision making, the political level. And on that level, I at least hold Netanyahu and whoever was part of this decision, I hold them responsible because they were supposed to know that there is a considerable risk of an Iranian reaction. And as important, if not more, that this action would not be acceptable to the Americans.
So it sounds like you're putting it somewhere between miscalculation and intentional provocation.
Yes, that's a good way of putting it. And I think there might have been around the table some people that were on the miscalculation side and some people that were on the intentional side.
The United States is urging restraint. Again, Europe is as well. Iraq, even Russia urging restraint at this point. Do you think Benjamin Netanyahu will listen to those calls?
Unfortunately, Netanyahu is at a phase in his career, in his political life, in his personal life. Essentially, he's not listening to anything and anyone. He's totally focused on his political survival, and he's willing to cause this country grave damage in his quest for political survival. And everything that has happened in Israel since early 2023, and then what happened in October 7th, and what happened since in terms of the botched way in which this war has been managed, and especially in recent months and weeks where it's becoming clearer and clearer to most Israelis, to the American administration, to the international community, that there is now a very clear differentiation between Netanyahu as a person, as a politician, as a prime minister, and the way he is making decisions on the one hand, and the actual Israeli interest and the Israeli people, 80% of which want him gone. And this is extremely troubling for us Israelis, most Israelis, because we know that we are being led by a person that does not take our actual interests or the national interests into account.
Eran, we have to leave it there. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Eran Etzion is the former deputy head of Israel's National Security Council. We reached him in Shoresh, near Jerusalem. It's not the kind of history he likes to be at the center of. Nevertheless, today was a historic day in New York as Donald Trump's hush money trial got underway. It's the first time a former U.S. president has faced a criminal trial. Last year, the Manhattan District Attorney charged him with dozens of counts of falsifying business records in order to, quote, conceal damaging information and unlawful activity from American voters before and after the 2016 election, unquote. The case centers on alleged payoffs to two women who say they had extramarital sexual encounters with Mr. Trump, adult film star Stormy Daniels and former Playboy model Karen McDougal. Mr. Trump has denied the affairs and pleaded not guilty to the charges. Jennifer Rogers is a former federal prosecutor, a law professor at NYU, and a legal analyst with CNN. We reached her in New York earlier today.
Jennifer, as you well know, jury selection is a key part of any trial. In this one, though, you know, we're talking about someone who is a former president, certainly well known, hundreds of potential jurors in the pool. But how are they going to pick people who can do what they need to do here and come in and be fair and impartial?
Yeah, good question. They're going to ask the prospective jurors a lot of questions. There's a 42-question questionnaire that went out, which has lots of subparts, asking them all sorts of stuff about what they do. Do they have family? Do they have anyone they know in law enforcement? And then their views on a whole bunch of stuff, whether they've ever worked for the Trump Organization, you know, all sorts of questions kind of trying to get at not only who they are, but what biases they may have. So that'll give the parties a lot of information. And then the judge is going to allow jurors to basically self-dismiss by saying, if you cannot be fair and impartial here, if you don't think you can, let us know. And then he's going to excuse all of those people without even further questioning them. So the group that we start with should at least exclude those people who just put their hands up and say, it can't be me. And then the answers to these questions in this very lengthy questionnaire and the party's follow-up on those questions will give them more information to decide, is this someone that we want to strike or we can let go through until ultimately get on the jury?
Then when we talk about potential witnesses, there's certainly a long list there. Who are you going to be watching for? Who do you think might be the most consequential?
Well, certainly Michael Cohen is central to the case. I think that's what everyone is watching for, because he's not only the person with the most relevant evidence, because he's the one who negotiated with and paid off Stormy Daniels. And of course, he famously broke with Trump. There's a lot of animosity between the two of them. And also, Michael Cohen is someone who pleaded guilty to a variety of federal offenses, one of which was connected to this. So he's a convicted felon. One of the crimes he was convicted of is lying under oath. So, of course, there's going to be vigorous cross-examination on that. So for all those reasons, his importance as a witness, the animosity there, the aggressiveness that will be the cross-examination, Michael Cohen's testimony is going to be probably the most explosive.
Do we expect Donald Trump to take the stand?
I don't think so. That would be a big risk for him. You know, he's a famously undisciplined speaker and witness. And also, there's so much potential cross-examination there. You're allowed to cross-examine not only about the issue at hand and anything he says on direct, but you're allowed to cross-examine on impeachment material, including evidence of someone's reputation for dishonesty. And if you think about all of the things out there that show that Donald Trump has a reputation for dishonesty, there's just so much material there. So even if they get the judge to limit somehow the prosecutor's ability to go into all of that, which they might, I think it's too risky for Donald Trump to take the stand given what kind of witness he is and what the cross-examination would look like.
He's certainly making a statement already without saying a word, according to the New York Times' Maggie Haberman, a reporter writing today, quote, Trump appears to be sleeping, his head keeps dropping down, and his mouth goes slack, unquote. Obviously, jurors haven't been selected yet. They won't be seeing that. But what do you think when you hear that? What impression might that send?
That's surprising. I mean, maybe he was, you know, unable to sleep last night and he's just really tired today. But I think once the jurors come in, he's going to want to be attentive and he's going to want to take this seriously. Jurors are always watching. I mean, there's going to be 18 of them, right? 12 plus the alternate. So someone is always going to be looking at him. And I'm sure his lawyers are going to be advising him that someone will always be watching. And so you always want to have the right facial expression, you know, be doing the right thing. And I think falling asleep during the trial would not send the right message to anyone. So I'm sure his lawyers will tell him to do what he needs to do, get caffeinated up or whatever, to be able to stay awake during everything.
Many people will wonder, you know, what will this case, what could it mean for him politically? If there's a conviction, he can still be the Republican nominee. He can still run, right?
He can. He can. Our Constitution only has three requirements for the presidency, and not being a convicted felon is not one of them. So he can still run. He can still win. He can still govern. I mean, you know, we're way down the road from this, but in theory, you know, you think about what happens if he actually was sentenced to prison while he was president. I don't know what would happen then, but there's no reason that he can't run. We know he is. And, you know, I expect he'll continue to do so. I don't know what the voting public's reaction will be to a conviction here if it happens. That's more for the political folks. And frankly, I don't even think they know. But, you know, we're a few weeks from finding out. And I guess we'll see what the polls say if, in fact, that comes to pass.
This is, of course, only, you know, one of the cases that Donald Trump is facing, but likely the only one that's going to go to trial before Election Day. How does how do you weigh the significance of this particular case?
Well, because it is likely to be the only one, I think it's very significant. I mean, if we had all four of them, if they had started earlier and all of these things that have happened, the Supreme Court hearing the immunity question, et cetera, had happened last year, and we were in a position to have multiple trials before the election, then I would say that this one wouldn't be much of a blip because the others are certainly more serious in terms of the conduct charged. But given that it's going to be the only one, I think it's going to be really important. It's going to be put to the voters, you know, if he's convicted. Do you want someone as the president who is a convicted felon, who did what these jurors agreed that he did? So, you know, in that kind of scheme of things, I think it's really important.
Jennifer Rogers, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jennifer Rogers is a former federal prosecutor for the Southern District of New York. She's also an adjunct professor of clinical law at NYU. We reached her in New York earlier today. Merlin the parrot is taking flight, and he will have the vegetarian meal. Today, the mainstay of the Maritime Museum of the Atlantic got on a plane and began the journey to a new life in Ontario. He's been the mascot of the museum since 2006, which suited him for years. But like so many of us during pandemic lockdowns, when he wasn't seeing as many people, he began to show signs of depression. Museum visitors have since returned, but Merlin has not quite returned to his cheerier self. So the museum staff made the tough decision to part with Merlin for the sake of his health. We reached Maritime Museum Manager Kim Reinhardt in Halifax.
Kim, you had to say goodbye to Merlin today. What was that like?
It was hard, for sure. I mean, it was something we knew we would have to do today, but there's something very poignant when you walk into work and say hello, Merlin, and realize that this is the last morning we have the opportunity to be greeted by friendly Merlin with a big hello, Merlin.
How do you say goodbye to a parrot?
Well, he's had a lot of attention this week. It's and so he's been really kind of hamming it up, and you know, it's hard. You just you know you just you just have to go with the feeling that this is the best thing for him, and that's what keeps us all kind of going and motivated with this initiative.
And he's had a lot of attention, not just from you and your colleagues, but Haligonians who were able to visit, because you all announced this decision to move him last week. So how are Haligonians reacting?
You know, you prepare for the worst. Like, are people going to be upset? How are they going to feel? But it's been overwhelmingly positive. Everyone seems to be able to recognize that this is just such an incredible opportunity to provide a space for Merlin where he can be outdoors, he can be with other macaws, things that we just simply can't provide for him here at the museum.
You did send him off with a souvenir.
Yes, yeah. Derek Harrison has been at the museum a long time. Derek wears a cap, but one of Derek's caps has been chewed up a fair bit over the years because Merlin likes to poke fun at it and literally put holes in it, grabbing it from Derek's head at times. And so when he was being moved into his pet carrier for his transportation today, the animal provider from Safari Niagara asked, is there anything familiar that we could put in there just to help keep him calm for his journey? And Derek offered up his cap, which I think is one of the best things you could put in there to help Merlin feel comforted.
Yeah. You and Merlin, your time at this facility kind of, you know, ran parallel. He's been there since 2006. He started not long after that. So, you know, you became buddies. You got to know him pretty well. So what were some of his trademarks, words and behavior?
Yeah, you know, he's a character. He really is. And he loves to tease. Some mornings you come into work and he's right on the main floor of the museum. When you come in, he's right in the lobby. And I almost always have time to run over and wish Merlin a good morning and play a little game of peekaboo or something with him. And there's some mornings when I'm just, you know, you're rushed. You've got to get to another meeting and you run in and you forget to run over and say good morning, Merlin, or hello, Merlin. And he will squawk when you do that. He'll be going, hello, Merlin. Little things like that. It makes you laugh and makes you pause and appreciate the little things, you know, that only beloved animals can do, right?
Yeah, only a parrot named Merlin, maybe. He had some favorite words, right?
Yeah, he had some vocabulary. He loved to play peekaboo, so if he wanted to play with you, he'd start dancing on his perch and would say peekaboo. Sometimes he'd get tired, and he'd actually say, I tired. So we would put up some signs, ask people to let him rest.
So when did you notice and how did you track that something wasn't right?
Yeah, well, as you said, you know, he's been here a long time, so we were familiar with Happy Merlin behaviors, right? How he is. But then at the time of the pandemic, we had shutdowns and we had to change up our routines. I think that was hard for Merlin. You know, he likes his routines. He knows when to expect people in. So that was the beginning of noticing that he just seems not himself, a little bit down, and he began to break off some of his feathers. So we got support from the vet and asked what to do. And the vet had some recommendations and some medication for him. She thought that the breaking of feathers was an indication of a little bit of stress or anxiety. We, even though the museum was closed during periods of time during the pandemic, we always had people come in to spend time specifically with Merlin, listen to music with him, read stories, just hang out with him, just to help counter any loneliness. And so despite everything that we could do and the port, he just didn't fully get back to that happy Merlin.
You mentioned, you know, during the pandemic, he missed the people at this new facility. As you've also said, there's going to be loads of other birds there. How do you think he'll react to that or fit in?
He's never been with another bird, so they have promised that what they're going to do is integrate him slowly into this new space. But Safari Niagara is quite well visited, so he'll have human visitors still, which he's used to. That's what he's used to. But in time, he'll be fully integrated into a large, beautiful environment space that they have. That's what makes us happy. This is sad that we have to say goodbye, but he's just going, like, we're just so excited about what that future is for him.
Kim, thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Kim Reinhardt is the manager of the Maritime Museum of the Atlantic in Halifax. That's where we reached her. What do birds dream about? Do they dream of grabbing onto a worm and it turns out to be a really long worm? Or flying over a sea of people wearing brand new hats and effortlessly soiling each one? When they're anxious, do they dream of waking up inside an endless house of windows? Or landing on a telephone wire and suddenly realizing they don't have their feathers on? Until now, what birds dream was just an extremely common subject of water cooler conversation. As we all know, those conversations could get pretty heated, but we had no definitive answers. We simply did not know what birds dreamt. But now, thanks to researchers at the University of Buenos Aires, we know what one bird dreams. That bird is a great kiskadee, so named for its three-syllable call. Like other birds, this is interesting. When a great kiskadee dreams, it sings in its sleep without making a sound. Its vocal muscles move as though it's producing sounds, though. So the researchers figured that if they tracked the movements of the bird's vocal muscles, they could figure out what sound it would produce. And they determined it was this sound. That's a sound known as a daytime trill, and it's the sound a great kiskadee makes when it's battling over territory, which strongly suggests that it was having a dream about that. Gabrielle Mindlin, who led this study, says, quote, "I felt great empathy imagining that solitary bird recreating a territorial dispute in its dream," unquote. And that's true. It's so much like dreams we have. It sounds like a stress dream. But when birds have fun dreams, do they dream they can fly?
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart MacLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
A few years ago, the world's eyes were on Belarus, on an election widely viewed as rigged in favor of President Alexander Lukashenko, on the protests against him, and on the crackdown that followed. Today, the focus has shifted to the tensions between Iran and Israel, to the war in Gaza, to Russia's war against Ukraine. But the opposition leader who challenged President Lukashenko is still fighting against the regime and for the hundreds of political prisoners behind bars in Belarus, including her own husband. Svetlana Tikhanovskaya lives in exile. She travels around the world pressing for support for human rights in her homeland. We reached her today in Ottawa.
Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, the Canadian government announced new sanctions, as you well know, today against 21 people in Belarus. What difference could those sanctions make? Hello?
Important political message to Belarusian authorities or businesses who run Lukashenko that be watching closely what's going on, that your crimes against Belarusian people will not stay unpunished. And it's an important message for Belarusian people as well that you are not abandoned, that we are with you, just to show that we're with you.
This is the latest in a series of sanctions from Ottawa against people and organizations in Belarus, but other countries have issued similar sanctions as well. So far, what evidence is there that the sanctions are actually having an effect?
Sanctions are important. Sanctions is not a silver bullet, but they help to weaken the regime, deprive regime of resources that they use to repress people. But honestly speaking, sanctions cannot work effectively if sanctions have loopholes. And this is the situation with Belarus and Russia, because most sanctions on Russia are imposed on import, on the Belarusian regime, on export. And these two people, dictators, using each other to circumvent sanctions. So there should be mechanisms of sanction enforcement, like secondary sanctions or accountability for businesses if help to avoid sanctions. So we need synchronization of sanctions between Belarusian regime and Russia, but without any derogations.
The people targeted in these latest Canadian sanctions are part of the apparatus that cracks down specifically on dissenters. So authorities involved in arresting people, detaining them, and potentially mistreating them in prison. We know just a few days ago, Alexander Kulinich, one of those prisoners, died. This is a case and a story, of course, you've been following. What can you tell us about what happened to him?
Political prisoners in Belarusian prisons are treated very badly, you know, inhumanly. People are not given any medical assistance. We have hundreds of people who are in extremely dire physical or health situation, people with cancer, people with diabetes, heart attacks, and we don't know the peculiarities of this death. Many people have, many political prisoners died behind the bars, but I can believe that it's the result of torturing people or lack of medical assistance. You know, this brutal attitude to political prisoners is revenge on people who were brave enough to oppose dictator. And one more of way of torturing people is keeping political prisoners in incommunicado mode. It means that lawyer cannot visit political prisoner, letters are not delivered, so people are kept in full isolation. We don't know what's going on with many people, including my husband. I haven't heard anything from him for 1 year already.
Sergei.
I don't know if he, Sergei, I don't know even know if he's alive, you know, how in what health condition he is, and you know, it's so painful.
He's been in prison for 4 years now, your husband.
For 4 years already, yeah.
We've also covered the story of Nobel Prize winner and human rights activist Aleš Bielecki on this program. His wife is saying that his health is deteriorating. He's been in a penal colony for more than 1,000 days now. Have you heard anything about his condition?
As well as my husband, Aleš is kept in incommunicado mode. And we don't get access to him. Time to time, he managed to send some letters to his wife. Aleš Bielecki is a real hero of Belarus. He has launched the biggest human rights defending center, Vesna, that is now the main source of information about political prisoners and helping repressed people. Of course, I think that the world's attention has to be more focused on human rights abuses in Belarus, on the situation with political prisoners, and track it as a humanitarian disaster. And all the international organizations, UN structures, have to demand at least access to political prisoners to see the health conditions, and all the people among political prisoners who is in dire health conditions I mentioned before have to be released unconditionally.
You know, we mentioned, our listeners heard that you're visiting capitals around the world, summits as well. After a day like today, when you get these sanctions against 21 people in Belarus, does it feel, can it feel like a success?
It's a small step towards victory of Belarusian people against dictatorship. You know, our fight is like paved with these small steps. it's responsibility of Belarusian people to return our country back, to hold free and fair elections, to release our people. And we are not asking the world to fight instead of us. But we are asking the democratic world, strong leaders, communities to help us to win this fight. No one fight has been won without allies. And all these steps, big or small, that's aim is to weaken the regime or strengthen civil society are very important for us. This is our strategy. So it is to some extent, of course, success because attention on Belarus is still alive in Canada. Canada is our very good partner. And I hope that Canadian people and Canadian nation understand why the government is doing this. It's like a huge step for people of Canada to understand that the fight for democracy is global one. Belarus is so far away. Why Canada has to support Belarusian democratic movement, changes in Ukraine, because we are fighting with the evil, with the beast, with the dictators who are a threat not only to Belarus and Ukraine, it's a threat to the whole democratic world. And our success is your success as well.
Svetlana, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Svetlana Tsikhanouskaya is the leader of the Belarusian opposition. She's in Ottawa. There are pro athletes who believe that winning is the only thing that matters. The NBA's Boban Marjanovic doesn't seem to be one of those athletes. The 7'4" Houston Rockets center is up for the league's Sportsmanship Award this season, and on Sunday, he was feeling generous, though not in a way the owner of his former team may have appreciated. That former team is the LA Clippers, and the Rockets were playing the Clippers in their final game of the season. The outcome didn't mean much for either team. But there was a flurry of excitement when Boban Marjanovic missed a free throw. He rarely misses two in a row, but then both the crowd and Mr. Marjanovic seemed to remember the Clippers' policy of giving everyone a free chicken sandwich when an opposing player misses two free throws in a row. Here's how broadcasters Ryan Hollins and Craig Ackerman called the play.
Fans are getting excited here. There might potentially be some free chicken on the board if he misses the second free throw.
Oh, man, free chicken on the board.
Yeah, so that's why the fans are getting a little frothy.
Oh, they're pointing to you. Boban's playing with the crowd. Say, you want chicken?
Here's your job.
No, he gave him chicken. He's a man of the people. He's a man of the people.
Think he did that on purpose?
He did. He gave out free chicken.
Ryan Hollins and Craig Ackerman calling the Houston Rockets' final game of the season against the LA Clippers yesterday. Boban Marjanovic scored 13 points and 8 rebounds in the game when free chicken wasn't on the line, and his Rockets won 116-105. Andrew Reed was spending his Saturday looking for a bunk bed for his kids. And then the shopping mall he was at turned into what he's described as a war zone after an attacker with a knife started stabbing people. Six people were killed and a dozen more were injured, including a baby, near Bondi Beach in Australia. Andrew Reed is a lifeguard who stars in the reality TV series Bondi Rescue. We reached him in Sydney, and a warning, some details in the story he tells about that day are disturbing.
Andrew, you are in a running group with one of the victims, Ashley Good. Her family has described her as, quote, a beautiful mother, daughter, sister, partner, friend, all-around outstanding human and so much more, unquote. How would you describe her?
Oh, I think they summed it up really well. Just a beautiful soul. You know, not many people turn up to a running group at 5 a.m. with a big smile on her face. On their face like Ash did. You know, it's most people are still asleep for another 2 hours after 5 o'clock, so she's definitely my type of person. I ran at 4 a.m. again this morning, and just because I wanted to get my run done and wanted to think about Ash sort of and just have a bit of time to myself. And yeah, she's just a really special person.
She had a nine-month-old baby who was hurt but is alive, according to her family. If we go back to Saturday, as much as you're comfortable doing, how did you find out about what was happening?
We're informed by one of the people that work in the department store. We're in that people were getting hurt outside in the shopping center, and so we were told to evacuate. I went to evacuate. The shutters were down, so we couldn't. I looked through the holes in the shutters to see what was going on out there, and that's when I heard the gunshots. And they were really loud because the shopping center's obviously enclosed and it was really echoey, and yeah, it was quite eerie. But then as I panned down to level four, I was on level five, I could see a woman just covered in blood laying on her side, being helped by another bystander, and I just knew I had to go down and help.
Your lifeguard, as our listeners have heard, were you able in the – I mean, that's a very dangerous situation. Authorities would not advise doing that in such an active situation, but with your expertise, you wanted to help. Were you able to?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's when we see – that's 20 years on the beach. When you see someone hurt, that's kind of – we sort of run towards them. I wasn't really thinking about the danger. I was more thinking of what I had to do to help stop the bleeding and just sort of, I guess, thinking about my training. Mm-hmm. So I literally went down the escalators in Maya and asked the security guard to open the shutters for me. And he opened them a little bit and let me slide under and then shut them back up again. Mm-hmm. And then I went around the corner and just sort of got to work on her. And then and we sort of got her stable. And when I looked up, I realized there was police running around everywhere and they were looking for another attacker. And I just thought, oh, hang on a minute, maybe we've put ourselves – that's when I sort of thought, oh, maybe it's a little bit dangerous. Mm-hmm. But then when I looked over and saw another patient or another victim with probably way worse injuries and two police officers working on her, I thought I've just got to go and help her as well. So went over and helped her and did some CPR on her and tried as hard as we could to get her back. But unfortunately, I don't think she made it. So yeah, we did a fair bit of work on her, and then that's when I was going to the third victim that was probably a little bit further down, that's when I noticed the pram just sitting there on its own. And I just wondered at this time I didn't know that it was my friend Ash's, because Ash and her baby had already been taken away, or maybe she was in the shop. I have no idea, but there was just a pram on its own, and it just looked eerie. And I've got three young kids. I just feared for whatever had happened.
You've mentioned her several times. Each time you saw a victim, New South Wales State Police Commissioner Karen Webb has said, quote, "It's obvious to me, it's obvious to detectives, that seems to be an area of interest, that the offender had focused on women and avoided the men," unquote. So much was going on, obviously, but is that something you noticed at the time?
To be honest, I've been asked that question once before. Mm-hmm. They were just humans to me. They weren't gender. It was just people were in trouble and they were hurt, and I just needed to help because I had good first aid training. Yeah. I mean, it's horrible if that's the case, of course, but, you know, it's horrible if it was, you know, it's horrible that people are getting hurt, I think, you know.
And in the few days since that stabbing, we heard of another stabbing at a church in the suburb of Wakeley. There's no indication that there's any link between these two events. But I wonder how you're holding up, how your kids and your friends are, because this is a lot for any place, but particularly Australia.
Yeah, look, it's horrendous. Like, what happened in Westfields on Saturday was just something that we never ever want to see here again. You know, we do hear about stabbings sometimes here in Australia. It happens. It's probably going to be more topical now that this horrendous incident's happened for a while. But yeah, I mean, everyone's just — there's a pretty good community here in Bondi, and we all sort of support each other. And I think you've sort of noticed that, the way that everyone's a little bit friendlier, you know, a little bit. You know, they're a little bit more – they're showing a little bit more compassion towards everyone, because everyone's sort of been through a bit and everyone can relate to some sort of story that's happened over the last few days.
What do you tell your children?
My kids are too young. I've got a 2-year-old, a 3-year-old and a 4-year-old. So my kids are too young. They won't know anything about it. And I'm glad. There was actually some footage of a parent that was walking out of the shopping center with his kids, and he covered their faces up. Our kids don't need to have the weight and the burden of this terrible incident that happened in society. They've got enough to worry about, I think. So if my kids were a little bit older and they had watched the news and stuff, then it would be a different conversation, I think. But at the moment, my kids are too young.
Andrew, I'm glad you're okay, all things considered. Thank you very much for your time.
No probs. No probs. Thank you.
Take care.
That was Australian lifeguard Andrew Reid. We reached him in Sydney. If you're from Manitoba, you should probably sit down. I have some news. Your province has lost the wellspring of what may be its greatest culinary tradition. It has lost the fountainhead of honey dill sauce. Now, if you don't know what honey dill sauce is, I'm going to refer you to Wikipedia, which says, quote, "Honey dill is unique to Manitoba, Canada, and is often used as a dipping sauce for chicken fingers. It was mistakenly invented at Mitzi's Chicken Finger Restaurant in downtown Winnipeg," unquote. Well, on Saturday, after a run of more than 45 years, Mitzi's Chicken Finger Restaurant sold its final order of fingers and fries, accompanied by its final side of that glorious mistaken invention. And we don't know who that lucky last diner was, but here's how Graham McDonald secured the first spot in line for Mitzi's 4:30 opening time.
Been here since 1:15.
1:15, and why do you want to come out here?
It's a Winnipeg institution. I mean, they invented honey dill sauce and they have the best chicken fingers in town, so...
Mitzi's an institution in Winnipeg. For people who maybe don't know, like, what would you say is, like, the legacy of Mitzi's here in Winnipeg?
Honey dill sauce. I think it's the biggest thing. Because, I mean, you can get it at, like, all types of different restaurants now. And, like, everywhere that serves, like, chicken fingers or fried chicken is going to have honey dill sauce. But weirdly, if you leave Manitoba, it is very hard to find. I found it, like, once in Saskatchewan, but if you mention it to any non-Manitoban, they have no idea what you're talking about.
And so for the folks who run Mitzi's, I guess, what would you want them to know about, like, how important their restaurant has been to the city or how it's been to people here who are in line?
I doubt that I will ever find chicken fingers that are as good again. The breading is perfect, and it's always crispy on the outside, juicy on the inside. I may just stop eating chicken fingers because there's no reason now that Mitzi's gone.
That was possibly former chicken finger eater Graham McDonald speaking to CBC Manitoba's Gavin Axelrod. Now, I want to reassure concerned Manitobans. Mitzi's restaurant is closed, but we've heard reports that their honey dill sauce is going to live on. A minute of silence was held in Liverpool today to mark the 35th anniversary of the Hillsborough disaster. On the 15th of April, 1989, 97 people were killed in a crush at a football match. It's still considered to be the greatest tragedy in British sport. And ever since, the families of the victims have been relentlessly fighting to hold the police and media to account. Steve Kelly was 35 when he lost his brother in the tragedy. We reached him in Liverpool.
Steve, I know you were at an event to mark this difficult anniversary. How did you remember your brother and the others who were killed that day?
Well, today I went to a place in Liverpool, which was arranged by good people over a number of years, called Hillsborough Oaks. It's a place where a number of oak trees have been planted, and there now there's 97 representing each and every individual who lost that day. And it's just a nice experience there. It's good friends, good company, and a lovely place to remember our 97. You know, maybe talk about the court cases we've been involved in, or we might share something humorous. It's not always a sad event. You know, we might mention a funny story about our family member. But we do sort of speak of our loved ones, it's usually start off with how much we miss them and wonder what they'd be doing these days, if they were 35 years older. Because it's a funny, one I always talk about, my brother, I always sort of take the mickey out of him, really, is that, I mean, I was 35 when Hillsborough happened, and I'm now 70, so half of my life has been campaigning and fighting for truth, justice and accountability.
He was in his late 30s when he was killed.
Yeah, he was 38, Michael, yeah. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's no age, is it? You know, it's... and certainly, I think that's been one of the difficult things about Hillsborough. In any ordinary form of life, you know, we go through the life cycle, don't we? And we lose somebody and we go through a period of grieving, mourning, and we can move on in our lives. Unfortunately, with the 97 at Hillsborough, you can't, because it's constantly rammed down your throat. There's obviously reminders throughout the city with a number of memorials and things, you know. So you're very, very rarely away from it.
What would have to happen, Steve, for you to be able to escape it?
Well, I don't think I ever will now, because, as I say, you know, it's been exactly 35 years of my life, and I think we've still got work to do, you know. We're trying to bring in a Hillsborough law in this country whereby, you know, ensuring people will never have to go through again what we went through. You know, a Hillsborough law, it was a review led by then Bishop of Liverpool, the Reverend James Jones. It was called, and his review was called the Patronising Disposition of Unaccountable Power. Mm. And he made 25 recommendations that hopefully, you know, would be in place to ensure people would never suffer this type of event again. And just a couple of the points in it was putting in place a duty of candour for all police officers and public officials, which means they must be open and honest from the get-go.
Because there was a cover-up.
Hiding away. Yeah, rather than hiding away evidence. Exactly, you said it exactly right. You know, not relying on interviews as a serving policeman.
Last year, there were some significant developments. The British government apologized last December to you and the other family members and apologize for the delay in responding to the 2017 report on this. There was also police chiefs across Britain promised, quote, cultural change in January of last year. Have those helped you and the others heal in any way?
Well, again, and I can only speak personally here, but I know I do speak for a lot of families and survivors of Hillsborough. And in a word, it's no. You know, it took so long and it was covered up for so long. And, you know, it was found out in the inquests, in the criminal court trials that followed, that the police were lying. There was politicians who made statements, you know, around the time of the disaster, saying that, you know, it was the fans. It wasn't the fault of the fans. Fans were 100% exonerated. It was the faults and failings of the police chief. Please, I'm not looking for anyone to sort of say, poor me. But since Hillsborough, I mean, I lost my mum, my sister, and my partner, my youngest son.
I'm sorry.
Now, I've dealt with that as a human being. You know, I've gone through that grieving process. I know how they died. I know what caused their problems or, you know, their health issues, whatever it was. But with my brother, I don't. And I've got some policemen telling me, you know, some people behind him were pushing him and they were drunk and he was standing all over him. That wasn't the case. We need things in place where straight away, you know, you'll get these answers rather than waiting like we have. The fight was on three fronts: truth, justice, accountability. We didn't get all the truth. We haven't had all the truth. I still believe that. We didn't get justice. We've had justification for carrying on the fight, and we got no accountability at all because we were beaten by antiquated laws in the United Kingdom. and we need that to change, because, you know, I would hate anybody to have lived my life. You know, not only did I lose my brother, but I've lost 35 years of my life. I'd do it again in a heartbeat for him, but it should be, you know, something to stop that ever happening to people again. It's a crime in itself, isn't it?
Steve, thank you very much for your time. Please take care.
Oh, you're welcome.
Steve Kelly's brother died in the Hillsborough disaster in 1989. We reached Mr. Kelly in Liverpool. It's typically a straightforward procedure, but when it isn't, the pain has been described as excruciating, nauseating, and completely unbearable. Intrauterine devices, or IUDs, are one of the most effective forms of birth control. They're small, T-shaped devices inserted through the cervix to prevent pregnancy. It takes about 15 minutes to get one put in, and that can usually be done in a doctor's office. For many, it's a simple, relatively comfortable procedure, but others have described intense pain and cramping, sometimes to the point of vomiting or fainting. For those people, it's welcome news that some Planned Parenthood locations in the U.S. are now offering routine sedation for people who want IUDs. Managing patient pain is something Renee Hall has thought about a good deal. She's the medical co-director of Vancouver's Willow Reproductive Health Center, and we reached her in Vancouver.
Dr. Hall, you are already offering different types of pain management for patients who come into your facility. This news about some clinics in the U.S. offering sedation for IUD procedures, having those kinds of options, what will this mean for women coming into clinics?
Offering different options for pain management will give people more freedom to be able to choose IUDs as an option for contraception. A lot of people are avoiding IUDs because of the concern around pain. So if they know that we're going to discuss pain and make a management plan with them and that they don't have to worry so much about the insertion process, it's more likely that they'll get one. And it happens to be such an excellent and effective form of birth control for so many people. So it's unfortunate when people are steering away from it just because of pain.
Why do you think it's taken so long? Why has just over-the-counter meds been the norm for so long, when clearly so many people are saying this is really painful?
When IUDs were introduced, there wasn't a lot of pain management studies around them, and we were told that they're simple and easy to insert and that most people don't have too much trouble with them, which is true. But I think that voice of those who are having severe pain on insertion is getting louder, and they've had enough of being told that it shouldn't hurt and it's probably just a small pinch, and what their personal experience was is that it was a lot more than that. So I think people are taking women's pain a lot more seriously. And I think our scientific evidence hasn't really helped us a ton in this area because pain studies are so difficult. And as much as one thing that we've studied says it works, you'll find another study that says it doesn't. And so we've been feeling a little bit lost in this area. But I think that now a lot of us are realizing that we can't just say it's probably going to be fine. It's just a little pinch. And we need a better plan of action than that.
Yeah, better communication with the patients so they know exactly what is involved. Would that understanding, though, about questions of pain, would that understanding have been reached if this many women weren't vocal and if they weren't vocal on big platforms, including social media?
I think those of us who were inserting IUDs were already concerned about those who were having severe pain and trying to come up with options. So we were already training people to, consider and discuss all these different methods of pain control. However, it wasn't until women spoke up that I was able to get as much traction with a lot of physicians as well. So there was a lot of training that we did where people were saying, oh, I don't think that's necessary, right back to me as a teacher. Oh, well, I do them all the time. It's not a problem. And I'm trying to say, I'm telling you, they'll come to me after and say that their last IUD experience was very traumatic, and we do have to do something about it. And when I think healthcare community heard directly from people who were getting IUDs inserted that, no, it's not okay, no, it's not just a pinch, and yes, I do want more discussion, it just actually helped us move forward more with providing pain management options more widely.
What are the options that you provide?
So we offer people the option of oral medication and verbicane, as I call it. Of course, we always want to make sure we're making people feel comfortable with us as well, and making sure we're going through good informed consent, because that impacts fear as well. And then we offer freezing. And now we're offering an inhaled method of analgesia as well, which people are starting to use across this country, which they don't have in the States. So their only other option is sedation. Mm-hmm. We do offer sedation here as well, but it does take a spot in the OR, and it's not ideal for a number of different reasons, but it is definitely a tool in our armamentarium if we really do need it.
When would you go that route? With what patient would you suggest that for?
I always tell people when I'm training for IUD insertion is try to set yourself up for success, and a lot of that has to do with the history. So if there's someone who's saying they've had a really traumatic insertion before, they're absolutely terrified, then I listen to that and I hear that and I offer them what options we have available. And some people say, well, you're not getting an IUD into me unless I'm knocked out. And those are the kind of folks where I think, okay, sedation might be a great option. The other options are those who have difficult anatomy in some way. Difficult for us, absolutely normal for them. So that we might find out from ultrasound ahead of time, or for those who we know have had failed insertions in the communities.
And it can be riskier, sedation.
Yeah, it can be riskier. You have to have more personnel. It's not really remunerated in that way. It's meant to be just a simple little procedure. So then when you're taking an OR space and you get a nurse and you get IVs inserted and all these sorts of things, it does become a more complex procedure, which is why we're sort of starting to explore some of these options, like the inhaled options, which will soon be available in the States too in another couple of years. And I wonder if all of their sedation will switch over to that. Mm-hmm. We'll see. It's got a lot of promise.
What's your advice, doctor, to folks who are listening and they don't have access to your clinic, about what they should be saying and talking about when they're making a decision, whether it's to get an IUD or whether to have some sort of pain management? Because I think a lot of people walk into a doctor's office and they think that the doctor knows best, and certainly there's knowledge there, but a lot of times they're hearing what the kinds of things you were hearing, that, oh, it's fine, you know, just pop an Advil or things like that. What do you tell those patients?
I think it's important to find a place where they have a trusted provider, so someone that they feel comfortable with, but also that the comfort of the provider is important too. So you can ask questions about how often that they insert IUDs, and that helps. I mean, if you're doing it all the time, you know, it being a procedure that's 3 or 4 minutes instead of 15 or 20 definitely is going to make a difference to a person's pain experience.
Dr. Hall, thank you for your time.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure.
Dr. Renee Hall is the medical co-director of the Willow Reproductive Health Center in Vancouver. You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1 after Your World Tonight.
And you can, of course, also listen to our show online at cbc.ca/AIH or on the CBC Listen app, or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.